a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
It's 7 minutes after 11 on a Thursday morning. Zanro here, sitting in the chair as always, as is Dr. Carl joining us to talk science. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning.
And we have a very special guest, which I think you and I and most foodies are very excited about this morning.
Yes, especially the fact that Professor Charles Spence won an Ig Nobel Prize.
Oh, you love the Ig Nobel Prize.
I won one for belly button fluff. That's nothing compared to the sonic chip. I weep if only I could have come up with that. So Professor Charles Spence is the head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at Oxford, deals with senses. Psychologists find something surprising about what we do, like why when you walk into a room, suddenly you forget why you went there. But he's into how our different senses integrate, has done stuff with the space station and Mr.
Heston Blumenthal
himself, and is very witty and entertaining and he's knows sitting, so much stuff.
He's sitting in the studio with us right now, so we should say welcome, Professor Charles Spence, to Triple
J. Good morning, all.
And to Australia. We're really excited about having you in and encouraging people to take advantage of not one brain but two science brains this morning, particularly if you've got a question about the senses. It doesn't just have to be taste. It can be broader than that. Obviously, we've got a lot more things going on in our interaction to the outside world. Give us a call 1300 055 36. Now is the perfect time. I can see about three or four lines free. 1300 055 36. What kind of work do you do in your everyday life? I'm trying to get my head around what sounds like a very fun job.
Yes. Well, I'm a psychologist by training who works with the senses. Hearing, vision, touch, taste and smell. And really excited by kind of the latest findings in neuroscience, in brain science. We're learning all new things about how what we see changes what we taste, what we smell changes what we feel. And for me, my lab back in Oxford, what we try and do is take those insights from brain science and say, how can we apply them to everyday life? And that could be everything from warning signals for car drivers. It could be the paint colour in the room. What does it do to your psychology? And most recently, and most fun of all, I think, working on the psychology and the neuroscience of food and wine, something we kind of label neurogastronomy.
And this is a relatively recent field from in terms of a consumer point of view, isn't it? So many more restaurants are really excited by the things they can do with food from a scientific point of view.
And I think we've seen, like, the last few years, especially in the UK, kind of molecular gastronomy. Some chefs want to call themselves that, others not, but the general idea of sort of science in the kitchen. And that molecular gastronomy, I think, has been a lot about sort of the science of food and cooking, preparation techniques, and how to preserve flavour by cooking at low temperatures, say. I think the new stage, the neuro bit of the neurogastronomy, is all about trying to convince chefs and other food producers to sort of think about stimulating the brain of their diners, of their drinkers, and not just their taste buds or their tongue. So that involves kind of brain science rather than kitchen science. And with a lot of the chefs we work with, we sort of ask them about what goes into making the perfect meal for one of their diners. And they say it's all about sort of the food, how you source the ingredients, how you prepare them. Maybe it's a bit about how you present them on the plate when the diner first sees them, but that's kind of it. And for us, we want to say there's so much more, and it's everything else that's really exciting to us, how the plate, the cutlery, the lighting, the music, the smell, the way the dish is named on the menu, all these other things impact your experience, and we're trying to study, figure out how to demonstrate to these chefs just how important everything else really is.
That's very interesting what you said there about cooking at a lower temperature to preserve the flavours in a different way, because I was once lucky enough to see the world's oldest barbecue, about 28,000 years old, in Lake Mungo in New South Wales in the bottom left-hand corner. And we really haven't moved on all that much except a new way of heating stuff like using the microwave. But really, we're sort of cooking with the higher temperatures, and just something as simple as cooking them at different temperatures. Wow, it's so simple. but then at least there's so much.
That's right. But I guess it's sort of the barbecue that presents new flavours through high temperature cooking that you might not otherwise see in a food. Mm. The sort of burnt notes that we like that might cause us cancer and who knows what else.
Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Yeah, but kind of at the opposite end there, just what's the minimum temperature you can cook something at so that you preserve the natural flavours of the foods, their aromas, given that probably every extra degree, I'm not a kitchen scientist as such, but every extra degree is going to take away some of those aromas and flavours.
And change things.
Let's get into some talkback. I know there's going to be a lot of people standing by to ask questions of Professor Charles Spence. He's joining Dr. Carl. We're talking all about the senses here on Triple J Mornings. 1300 055 36 if you've got a question. If you've got a comment and you can't get through, don't forget you can always tweet Dr. Carl direct, or you can text us 0439 757 555 is the text number. Ken's calling in from Seven Hills this morning. Hey, Ken, turn down your radio.
Yeah, I am.
Thanks.
Welcome, Dr. Ken.
What's your question?
Best way to put it, I suppose, is does your brain actually memorise smell, right, and have a place in your brain? Because I aimed up the back of a truck one day, and it was a yeast truck, and that smell, which is a really strong smell, then sort of transported me back to where I was. The first time I smelt that was when I went on an excursion to a bakery. You know, like, and it was such a sort of, you know, instant thing. You just went, wow, I know that smell. And
Like Marcel Proust and his remembrance in the Madeleine cakes that bring back the memories.
Professor Charles.
It turns out smell's kind of maybe one of our most primitive senses. And in fact, when we smell things, it's actually part of our brain that's sticking out down our nose, the only sense that actually has part of our brain out there in the world.
Gross.
Picking up what's going on. And our responses to smells, it turns out, are all learnt. There may be no smells that are naturally pleasant or unpleasant. We learn everything, and we associate those smells with our early experiences, so that when we get those smells later in life, they can take us right back to our early childhood moments, say. And one of the smells we work with is a heliotropin flower, which if I present it in front of some adult, they'll say, yeah, that's familiar. They'll kind of relax. They won't know quite what it is until I tell them it's actually the smell that's put into Johnson & Johnson's baby powder, the smell we all had when we had our bottoms powdered years ago. And that, even though we might not have smelt that for 10, 20, 30 years, suddenly present that to somebody, the heart rate goes down, they start relaxing. They don't know quite why, but it's our brain storing that memory. And maybe with smells, the thing about smells is that they don't really come from anywhere in particular. If I'm in this room today, it smells a certain way, but that smell is associated with everything in the room, whereas our other senses tend to be much more fixed to just one particular kind of thing.
There you go. It does exist. Thanks for the call, Ken.
And you're saying that we learn our smells? Like, surely feces, poo, smell bad to everybody?
No. If you observe, as psychologists do, kind of young babies, quite often they'll stick it in their mouth, they'll eat it.
So that's learned.
Yeah, absolutely learned.
You learned.
We've learned it so well. We've learned it so well that you can't believe it. We ever had to learn it. But just look at what very young babies stick in their mouths, and you realise.
Glad that we had to learn not to eat our own feces. I'm glad that I learned that lesson early on.
I'm glad I learned that one too.
Shane is calling in from Adelaide this morning. Hi, Shane.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I've got really good long vision, but my short sightedness is really poor. Yet if I really force myself, I can read without glasses, because I lose my glasses, as everyone does, and then I'm forced to make myself read. Now, how does that happen?
I guess our senses all kind of work with a certain amount of acuity. We can see things to a certain distance or at a certain level of smallness of font. But also our brain kind of has resources, kind of attention, what we call concentration in the language of psychology. We don't have so much of it. And if we use it all the time, if we really concentrate on something, like trying to see without our glasses when we should really have our glasses on, we can do it for a while, but we're likely to get tired as we use up kind of the energy and the blood flow in our brain, all that glucose, in order to do things that's just beyond our natural capacities. So we can enhance any one of our senses by concentrating on it, but doing so is going to kind of tire you out after some period of time.
And there's also the adjustability in the lens. So you measure the bending power of a lens in a thing called a diopter, like weight is measured in kilograms and height in meters. And the front of your eye, the cornea, is fixed at around 45 diopters, but inside you have a lens. And when you're born, it can go 0 to 15 diopters. And my little daughter Lola, she could read with my 7 diopter glasses when she was about 5. Can't do it now anymore. So you've still got some adjustment left, so you can work it, but as Charles said, it's exhausting.
Hey, thanks for the call, Shane.
Thank you.
Good on you, mate. Danielle's calling in from Brisbane. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's your question?
Basically, it's actually following on from the previous question. My diopter is -5 in my eyes, and I've always wondered, my sense of smell is actually more improved, compared to friends, my husband, my kids. So does one sense, if one sense is faltering, can another sense sort of improve? You know how like parts of the body actually take over?
Absolutely they can, and that's kind of an area that's just exploding in recent years in psychology and neuroscience, this idea of plasticity, that when our when our brains lose one sense, there's kind of a bit of cortical real estate just waiting there. Most often it's been studied with people who have actually lost their vision, either congenitally blind or late blind. And when we study those individuals, their other senses do seem to take over that spare bit of brain and kind of co-opt it for hearing better or for smelling better. So what you experience is common to people who've lost a sense. But what's going on there is a little bit harder to figure out. So there's kind of two possibilities. One is that the spare bit of your brain is taken over by the other senses. So there's got more resources, more availability, more computational power. The other thing is maybe that with a loss of vision or a reduction of vision, you just kind of concentrate more on the sense of smell. And we're doing a lot of work with people, with wine experts, say, and chefs to say, if you're a wine expert, they seem to know all sorts about smells and they can smell smells and wines that I just have no idea what's going on. How do they do that? Are they born with an expert nose? And it turns out, in fact, we think most of it's a matter of practice, that what smell is one of the senses that we can really learn to improve most by... We all have the same smell threshold as a wine expert, but what the wine expert has that we don't is an ability to say, okay, that smell is a smell of rosemary, of lavender, of cat's piss, of lychee or something else. And that ability to put a name on a smell is a thing that really separates the experts from the others.
It's interesting because obviously the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and as with genetics, and my son, he's diopter already. He's turning 14. His diopter is minus 4, so I apologise to my son for that. But his sense of smell is also more improved compared to his friends. So that's why I sort of thought, is there a pattern developing here?
And even I work with some companies who work in South America, and there they actually employ blind panelists when they're evaluating the new fragrances for their washing powders, with this idea in mind that with that absence of vision, your smell's enhanced, and hence they are the best people to assess the new fragrance. Will people like it?
Oh,
what
perfect.
Does it make you think of?
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Danielle.
Thank you, Danielle.
Good on you. Joining Dr. Carl for Science Talk Back, Professor Charles Spence. He is from Oxford University and is currently working in one of the most exciting fields, I reckon, in science and consumer science in the world, which is neurogastronomy. Is that what it is?
That's it.
Neurogastronomy.
There's the brain on food.
The brain on food. So there's a bunch of restaurants and chefs around the world who are doing some crazy stuff with food, really messing around with how we experience food. Ferran Adrià from El Bulli in Spain, which is a famous restaurant. It's a tiny little place. Heaps of people want to go there. And a few months ago, he just said, I'm shutting the doors for 2 years. I'm going to go in the lab. I need to find something new. You've been inside that lab.
Mm-hmm. So I think for the molecular gastronomists, kind of we've been looking at this recently, what makes those restaurants so interesting to people. And partly it's about a kind of incongruence. It's things that look one way but taste a different way.
Mm.
So you see what looks like a strawberry, but it actually tastes of rhubarb. Something that's orange actually tastes of beetroot. And these kind of incongruences between the senses only kind of work in those molecular gastronomy restaurants, we think. Normally you like things that taste the way they look, that just match the label. But in the gastronomy restaurant, you're happy for your senses to be surprised. You want them to be surprised again and again, dish after dish. But those kind of surprises, I think, only work once. Once you've had the kind of the mandarin orange, it's actually chicken liver parfait at the world's number 9 restaurant announced yesterday, dinner in London. Once you've had that once, the surprise, you can't really do it again. It'll still taste good the next time, but you're missing that surprise, and hence you want something different. And hence I think the molecular gastronomy type chefs have one of the hardest jobs around, and I'm not surprised more of them don't take time out for a sabbatical like as academics get, in that they've got to create the new surprise, the next thing. They can't just rest on traditional favourites. Comfort foods isn't their thing. It's all about the surprise and the next new thing.
You must have the best job ever. You get to taste test all of these incredible chefs' creations.
Yeah, and it's we've been working on food for maybe 10 or 15 years now, and you kind of get drawn more and more into it, both because many of the chefs that we've spoken to are incredibly interested in the brain science and come to the lab in Oxford and really want to try and take the science and put it into their cooking to make their dishes even better than they already are from the best ingredients and so on. We get to eat some very nice meals around the world, which is a great part of the job. And we have lots of very young chefs, not the ones you haven't heard about yet, who are coming up and saying, okay, let's do something. I want to create this dish. What happens if I make my plate sing? What happens if I make my cutlery out of, copper or titanium or steel? What else can I do with the senses in order to enhance and change the experience?
One of the other chefs that you've been working with is Heston Blumenthal, who we mentioned at the start, and you've been working closely with him on a particular dish where you said, you saying, I want to make my plate sing. You've been working with sound and food. Mm-hmm. What's been going on there?
Yeah. I mean, I think when people think about food and drink, they think about taste and maybe smell and maybe what it looks like. And I guess kind of texture on the mouth, carbonation or fattiness or creaminess. But no one ever thinks about sound. It's kind of the forgotten flavour sense. It's one that we got to last of all and one that most chefs haven't really worked on. And we think it's just a huge potential there and a lot of excitement. And that starts both with the sound of foods, be it the sizzle of the steak as it comes to your table, be it the crunch of the crisp in the Ig Nobel Sonic chip from 2004, or be it the sound of packaging. You always wonder why crisps come in noisy, rattly packets.
No very good annoying in the cinema.
Yeah, no good reason at all. Maybe in the cinema when it's dark, you need noisy food. That's maybe why you need popcorn, something you can hear that you're eating. Otherwise, what do you know what's going in? But the sound of packaging as well, and the sound of the environment. I've been to so many restaurants, Michelin star ones included, where they spent so much time thinking about these perfect, beautiful dishes, that really a feast for the eyes and the mouth. And then they have the kind of the duty manager of the night putting his iPod on.
Yeah.
With this really terrible music that just doesn't match the dish, doesn't match the restaurant. And they don't realise there's something wrong with that.
It changes the experience.
And once you think about that, you say, okay, sound is so important. I can't just leave it up to anybody's trial and error. I want to consciously think about what goes best with my dish. And that can be everything from Italian music might make Italian food taste more authentic. It might change which wine you choose to purchase. Through to the sounds of the sea. It's kind of the seafood dish that... we worked out with Heston through experiments we did with kind of the chef and as giving people oysters. And oysters taste better, more pleasant when you have the sound of the sea. The sound, I guess, I was listening to yesterday lunchtime at Watson Bay.
So I can get my daughter, who hates oysters at the moment, the 13-year-old, to like them if I have a bit of sea beating in the background.
Manipulate. Yeah.
And the seagulls overhead, that helps a bit.
When you're at the football, why do meat pies taste better than they do if you get them out of the freezer and cook them at home?
That's not Matt Preston, is it?
No!
We asked that the other day.
It always tastes better, and hot chips as well, always taste better at the footy.
Yep. So something about kind of contextual effects, that certain foods go well in certain kind of environments that we've had them before, environments in which we expect them. And in a way, you can think of certain kinds of foods a bit like drugs. They have caffeine, they have alcohol, and there's a lot of literature saying, you know, people who are addicted to certain substances will crave them more if you put them back in the context in which they first experienced that drink or drugs or something else. Maybe exactly the same thing is going on for food. When we're in that environment, our brain just says, I want, I need, I'm about to get that thing, be it their meat pie and whatever else it might be.
And I'm going to pay $8 for it as well. Dr. Carl?
What about comfort food soup in winter? What's going on there?
A few things. Again, this is not the kind of stuff you're going to see at a molecular gastronomy restaurant. It's an antithesis of comfort foods. What are comfort foods? I guess they're things that take us back to our youth, to security and warmth, both metaphoric and literal, I think, there. And there's a lot of really exciting research. If you think about how many comfort foods are soups or teas or hot drinks, something you hold in your hand.
Oh, yes.
And there's beautiful research from the States showing that you'd think it shouldn't matter, but if I put a warm drink in your hand, I'll look nicer to you, I'll look more friendly. Our brains internalize the kind of the warmth of the plateware and the cups and use them and interpret. That helps us to interpret what's going on around us and how pleasant people seem.
Oh, because I was reading of a study where they got people to look at photographs and rate them.
Yep.
And then they gave them smells that they couldn't consciously smell.
Yep.
But if they gave it in high levels, they could smell it as being pleasant or unpleasant.
Yep.
And when they gave them the levels that they could not register as having smelt, if it was a bad smell, but they couldn't consciously smell it, don't like that person.
Yep.
Nice smell, I like that person. What's going on?
This might be one of our experiments. A few research groups are doing that, looking at attractiveness and beauty of a person we see either on a picture or in real life. And there you might think of sort of physical attraction as being primarily a visual thing. What do they look like? How symmetrical their faces, how beautiful. But in fact, beauty like flavour, like many of our experiences, are multisensory. And what that means, it's not just what we see, it's the sound of their voice feeds in. Also, the fragrance, the smell also plays a role. And very often what our brains do are kind of monitor the environment, the smells, the subtle sounds we don't think we hear, the smells we don't realise are going up our noses. But our brain picks up that information below the radar, below consciousness, and uses it to interpret what's out there and says, probably this person's really nice because they smell a certain way.
Let's get back into some calls. There's heaps of people waiting and we're kind of stealing your time. Professor Charles, there's so much to talk about. 1-300-055-36 is the number. Alana's calling in from Cairns this morning. Hi, Alana.
How you going?
Good. What's your question?
When I was pregnant and about halfway through my pregnancy, everything that I ate tasted like it was covered in insect repellent, like horrible, horrible tasting food. And I'm just wondering whether it's hormones or whether your brain just, like, I don't know, freaks out when when you're pregnant.
Yep. So I think it's a fairly common phenomenon that your sort of taste preferences, your sense of smell changes during pregnancy. And a number of women and studies showing that, in fact, many women actually find the smell of their husband deeply unpleasant during pregnancy.
Inconvenient.
And what's going on there, I think, is that our brain's kind of saying during the period of pregnancy, everything that you ate will be passed on to some degree to the young baby growing inside, and hence they need to be protected from certain sort of bitter foodstuffs, say, that might harm the developing nervous system of the child. And hence, by changing your food preferences, that'll change what the baby experiences. And here it's just amazing research being done now showing that, in fact, a lot of our food preferences in later life are determined by the foods that our mother ate when she was pregnant with us. And if you take women in sort of Alsace region of France, many of them eat a lot of licorice kind of flavoured foods. And if you have mothers who consumed licorice-type aniseed flavours during pregnancy, when the baby is born, that smell will get the baby to turn their head at birth. So we're learning our flavours, our experience, what we like, what we don't like, wow, in some part just from what's going on before we even pop out.
Thanks for the call, Anna.
Thank you.
We've got Trent from Newcastle on the line. Hi, Trent.
Hello, doctors. How are you?
Very well.
Trent. Welcome.
I was wondering about a high-pitched noise that I get in my ear. I don't have a history of hearing problems or anything like that, but It lasts for about 15 or 20 seconds, and then it'll go away. And it'll happen maybe two or three times a year. It's a very rare thing, but I'm not the only one that gets it. Like, I'll walk into my girlfriend's room, and she'll say, "Can you hear that noise?" And I'll say, "No." And I was wondering what causes it and what it is.
So I think I get something similar whenever I kind of open my jaw too wide. If I'm trying to get a really big hamburger in there, then I hear kind of that ringing sound just in my right ear that comes for a few seconds and goes, probably more often than your three times a year. And what may be going on there is some sort of confusion of the senses, a bit like synesthetes get when they see coloured numbers and days of the week, that our brain's got all these senses operating inside our heads with all this kind of the cables and the nerves passing information from the eye, the ear, the nose and the mouth up to the brain, that sometimes you get a bit of cross-activation, one sense talking to another one. And maybe that phenomenon that you experience as hearing in the absence of any actual sound out there might link into the kind of the things like the photic sneeze reflex, which is kind of about a third of people, when they see very bright sunlight, sneeze. And I used to have a girlfriend who would do it, her mother would do it, her grandmother would do it. It's quite funny. The whole family tree would do it because it passes down generation by generation. And why that should be, again, the answer is that maybe the optic nerve and the kind of olfactory nerve, the nerves for smell and vision, pass very close by each other, and a very bright light sends a really powerful signal down the visual nerve, and that sometimes triggers accidentally the sense of smell, and hence you sneeze because your brain thinks there's something in there, it shouldn't be there.
Ah, I was thinking that maybe because there's a mapping one-to-one of the hair cells in your cochlea to certain areas in your brain, the auditory cortex, and this is just a guess, maybe it's doing some sort of rebooting the system every now and then. I'm not very happy with that explanation.
But all of the computer metaphor of mind is one that's very popular in psychology from a decade or two ago. But I think they're changing it now. As technology evolves, the reboot would be a very 1980s kind of site.
Hey, thanks for the call, Trent.
No worries.
Thank you, Dr. Trent.
Doug is calling in from Brisbane. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, doctors. How are you?
Great. Doug, welcome. What's your question, Doug?
My question might stop the tummy's rumbling a little bit. it relates back to the Brisbane floods. When the waters had receded, I'm an emergency services worker. We were called in to clean out the cool rooms in a lot of the lovely hotels in the city. Basically, after three cleaning companies had been unable to do the job, and many firemen to this day say that was one of the worst jobs they ever had to do, purely because of the smell that was dealt with. It was visually fine to look at, obviously, but the smell was instantly sort of dry reached. Without protective equipment, it was a very difficult difficult job. And I just wondered, why is that impulse there to dry reach when you smell that smell? When you can look at something and there's no stimulus to do that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess through evolution, our brains are set up to avoid things that are poisonous, that might be bad for us. That's why we initially dislike bitter foods, for example. And that smell is maybe one of the most powerful triggers for kind of off foods. So we talk about examples like sort of beautiful fish that might look perfect visually on a stunning plate, but if it smells off, you'll never, ever touch it. That our sense of smell is so highly attuned to those off notes, off flavours that might poison us, that our brain says, "Nope, I won't go near there." I think
actually,
in the case
seafood was the worst to deal with.
and would it not, one could almost imagine then sending people out with some nose plugs on? Would that have helped?
Yeah, because you breathe through your mouth. You very little of the smell gets into the olfactory epithelium in the top of your nose. And the other thing I found useful is wearing the high-grade painters' nozzles, the spray painters, with the twin carbon granules, the activated granules, and that absorbs pretty well every smell. Did you try that then, Doug?
Yeah, what a lot of the lads did is they actually use Vicks. We carry a small packet of Vicks and just rub it onto your nose, and that
overpowers
to take away a lot of it. But this was just particularly strong and pungent, and we would issue protective equipment to deal with that. But even when you were 30, 40 metres from the actual cool room, the smell that was on your protective gear was enough to sort of make you go to the dry region again.
And maybe you get sort of similar kind of effect. Going back to the blue food, the blue theme, Alfred Hitchcock back in the 60s, 70s used to bring dinner guests to the hotel where he'd serve them dinner, and all the food was coloured blue, specifically because he knew that would really off-put people. They couldn't cope with blue meat, blue eggs. And there are other kind of case studies of people eating meals. Steak, chips and peas, 1973, the food du jour, kind of England. And halfway through the meal, the light's very dim and subdued. Halfway through the meal, the lights come back up to normal, and the diners realise the steak's blue and the chips are pink and the peas are some other vile colour. And that blue colour in meat was so powerful, a trigger for our brains, that many of the people who were there just kind of apparently ran off to the bathroom and just couldn't help themselves but be sick.
So there's a protective thing,
protective mechanism,
to vomit the food that's in your belly so that you don't
poisonous,
die.
Yeah.
There you go. That's an interesting question.
All this food was blue, black or green. That's the colour.
Horrible. Thanks so much for the call, Doug.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Good work with the cleanup. What a job. Christine's calling in from the Gold Coast this morning. Hi, Christine.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good. What's your question?
On another note, I'm off to see Heston tomorrow night in Brisbane. Lucky me. Yeah. But ice, the thought of ice or anyone grabbing frozen food out of the freezer or even watching it on the TV, instant goosebumps. I just can't stand someone eating an ice block. If I even see it in a movie, I get goosebumps. Why is this?
I guess it could be two things there. Maybe partly about sort of the imagery that we have. Some people have very, very vivid mental imagery. A lot of us think about we can see things when they're not actually there, have vivid visual imagery. But in the other senses, imagining sounds aren't there, or imagining textures or feels that aren't there, varies quite a lot between people. And some people, maybe like yourself, have very rich tactile imagery to do with the cold, temperature. Also, there's kind of a big difference between people in terms of how empathetic they are. That some people, when they see movies of somebody else being stabbed in a horror movie, say, they just can't watch it because their own body kind of reacts. They almost feel the pain. And maybe in your case, you're getting this kind of empathetic response to what it would be like for the other person to be holding that very, very cold type of thing.
So you're an empathetic person, Christine. Well done.
There you go.
Hey, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Jeremy's calling in from Manly. Hi, Jeremy.
Morning.
Good morning,
what's
Jeremy.
What's your question?
Look, I worked for an airline as a flight attendant, and I just wanted to talk about the relationship between food and the taste of food at altitudes as opposed to on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a bit of a work being done with the chef that looks after our airline. Just wondering why it tastes different at 10,000 metres above as opposed to on the ground.
Great. This is the thing I'll be facing this afternoon as I head back to Heathrow at 23 hours of in air. I'm worried about my food too. It will taste worse. Why is that? I think there's probably three things going on there. One thing is that kind of the high altitude, kind of the air pressure is reduced, and hence that suppresses the sort of volatile release of the smells off the food that will be more present in the air on the ground. That's part of the answer. Part of the answer is probably also the fact that a lot of the background noise in the air, also loud noise, suppresses our perception of food tastes. Not all food tastes equally, but in particular salt, our perception of salt in food seems to be suppressed by loud background noise. So if I can get hold of a pair of kind of sound cancelling headphones, that's one easy way in the air to actually bring some of the flavours back by blocking out the aircraft noise.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And the third thing is probably the cutlery we use. Eating food off light cutlery, off plastic cutlery that was so common in many airplanes, also makes food taste worse. The weight of the cutlery shouldn't matter, but it does. And we've just been doing research saying that the heavier the cutlery you use to eat food, the better the food tastes. And that even when Concorde was still flying, they spent lots of money trying to get the lightest cutlery they could find to save every ounce and dollar on petrol fuel charges. So they got the designers in who made some beautiful titanium cutlery. Visually stunning, incredibly light. But when they tried it out with diners, it just didn't work. People didn't like it. No
that's
matter
amazing.
How well it looked, it was just too light, and they said the food just doesn't taste right, and so that's kind of the third part of the answer, the thin atmosphere, the loud background noise, and the kind of the cutlery.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Interesting question. Oh, sorry, not Nick. Jeremy. Sorry, we're going to Nick. Sorry, Jeremy. Thanks so much for the call. Nick is on the line from Wonthaggi. Nick, you're a gleaner.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a uni student, so I do a bit of bin diving. I'll pull out, like, perfectly good food from supermarket bins where they've got a little bit of a bruise on them, like, that type of stuff. I'll cook up a meal for my housemates with perfectly good food, all clean, all good and everything. Put it on the plate, they'll eat it, they'll enjoy it. But as soon as I say I've pulled it out from the bin, there'll be this instant negative going, ooh, yuck. What goes on in your head to say that?
I think that it's partly contamination effect going on there that... If you find something very similar, if I gave you a jumper and said, put it on. So that's kind of a nice jumper. And I said, actually, that comes from one of Britain's worst serial killers. You take it off immediately. And I've seen it happen time and time again at kind of conferences when people wouldn't do this. And this fear of contamination, things that somebody else has touched that might be poisonous or bad or nasty, we don't want to be contaminated through touch with. So it's kind of the negative side of touch that we think just that somebody else has touched something, it could contaminate us. And then maybe on the reverse side, you see kind of in relics and stuff that people who are religious might want to have a bit of Padre Pio's glove. Just they can touch something that somebody famous or saintly has touched, and they'll get beneficial effects through that. And probably for my own case, we grew up, my parents were greengrocers in Leeds in England. And there we only ever had out-of-date food. Well, everything was too black and too old. Nobody else would buy. We had it. And my brother says he never saw a yellow banana till he was about 25.
So he worked up a resistance to it anyway. Yeah.
Well, I spent a 2-year period of my life as a desperately poor drug-crazed hippie where every Monday morning we'd go up to the greengrocers and they'd be taking the new boxes of food and we'd take out the old ones and stuff that was badly bruised into the compost and what was okay, we'd eat it. And survive and soybeans for 2 years.
And just you're almost doing an experiment there. This is kind of the experiment we'd love to do in the lab just to see how the labels you give to food, the descriptors, true or false about food, completely change the experience. And that's something that chefs have to deal with as well when they have a new dish or something that looks a certain way. I mean, for Heston, he experienced it with this, he made this new flavoured frozen mousse. Looks red, frozen. What do you think? You think it's strawberry ice cream or raspberry? Turns out it's kind of a frozen salmon mousse. It's a very salty dish that was popular in England a century ago. So it fits in with the theme of his restaurant. But when people saw that dish and ate it without the right label, they hated it. It tasted really salty. They wouldn't want to eat it again at the time or weeks later. As soon as he said, no, this is a frozen salmon dessert, people liked it. It didn't taste as salty, and they were coming back for more weeks later. So that labelling of foods and setting up the right kind of expectations plays a really big role.
Yeah, interesting thing to think about. Thanks so much for your call, Nick.
We humans don't deal with reality much at all, do we?
Speaking of salt, Keisha's on the line from Brisbane with a question about salt. Hi, Keisha.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm just calling because I heard somewhere, I'm pretty sure it was Heston who said it, that salt makes sweet things sweet. So I love like salted caramel and salted dark chocolate. And I was just wondering why is that true and why?
Mm-hmm. So I think it is true. And we have maybe like 5 basic tastes, salty, sour, sweet,
bitter umami.
Maybe metallic and a few others, but the 4 or 5 main ones. And they're kind of detected by somewhat different taste buds on your tongue. But actually, they kind of interact and interlink much more than we realised. And hence, sometimes one flavour, like bitterness, might mask sweetness. And one of the demonstrations that we do quite often with people is get like a glass of tonic water, because that's got sweetness in it, but it's also got the bitterness of the quinine. And there, you put some sort of salt into one cup of tonic, and you say to people, how will it taste now? And everyone thinks it will taste more salty, but in fact it tastes sweeter because the salt masks the bitterness, which in turn masks the sugar.
Oh,
so all these tastes do interact in ways we're just coming to understand now. And then as a chef or as a magician or something, you can start playing with them and putting one taste in to actually give you the opposite effect to what anybody would think.
Or a magician chef, even better. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Keisha.
Thank you, Keisha.
Hi, Anne-Marie.
Hello, how are you going?
Good. What happened in your mouth recently?
Well, it was a while back. Basically, I ate some pine nuts that weren't quite right. And for about a week and a half afterwards, everything I ate tasted bitter or metallic. And it happened to a friend of mine too. So we got together and looked it up on the internet. Apparently, the condition is called pine mouth, which is really pleasant. But I'm just wondering what causes that.
And a week and a half?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it is... unfortunate condition. Does last a long time and is unpleasant, as you describe it. I think the cause was tracked back to a batch of Chinese pine nuts.
Yes, yeah, I read that too.
So I think the source, they've been sourced now, so you're unlikely to get it again. So if you can get over that unpleasant experience, it was only one batch from China that had an extra chemical in them that because they weren't quite ripe enough or something that actually desensitized or changed the sensitivity in your mouth. Mm. They're on the bad side. I guess you could think of a shorter-term version of that in things like miracle berries. But also from Africa, that you put them in your mouth and then make everything taste sweet.
Yes.
That effect is
a
similar in mechanism, I guess. Yeah, but only lasts for maybe 30 minutes.
With the miracle
or so.
Berries, the chemical miraculant sits inside the sweet receptor, but very poorly, so it stops other stuff from getting in there. But when subjected to an acid environment, changes shape and fits into the sweet receptor a million times better than sugar. And so everything becomes incredibly sweet. So lemons have become sweet.
Yes.
So you can eat your way through this incredibly acid meal, enjoying it all away, but as Richard Feynman says, you can't fool nature, and you've got all this acid stuff in your stomach that's going to attack you an hour later.
Oh. There you go, Anne-Marie. It does exist. Thanks for the call.
Right, thank
Pine
you.
Mouth.
Liam's calling in from Adelaide. I think he has a bet to settle. Hi, Liam.
G'day, guys.
Dr. Liam?
Doctors, professor, this is a little way just to the professor. I'm wondering how people's perception of something changes the taste. I'm a competing barista, so how does changing something that I display to a judge change their perception of how it tastes?
In a big way. So everything from the verbal description you give, you can make people think that a drink tastes more or less bitter by the kind of the verbal label you give to that drink of coffee, say. You can also affect the taste and the flavour by the cup you serve it in, or the glass or the beaker. Not only the kind of what you might think of kind of congruent sort of shaped cups for particular kinds of coffee, but also the very weight of the cup. We've just been doing some research on hot beverages in England showing that if you give people a heavier glass or cup in which to drink their coffee or hot chocolate, it tastes better as a result. Even the colour of the cup might have an influence. So all of these factors are part of the story, that name, the colour, the weight, the texture of the cup or the beaker or the glass also impact.
Heavier is better, but what about the wafer-thin porcelain Chinese cups?
We're starting to work on that. So there's kind of two things going on. One thing about a transfer of the qualities from the plateware, from the cup, from the glass to our brains. Things about heaviness is good, warmth is good. On top of that, there's also this kind of cultural learning we have that certain sorts of plateware or porcelain go with certain kinds of foodstuffs. So that plays in a role too. Things taste better if they're in the plateware or glasses that you expect that they should be in. And in history, you find out odd examples of where actually lighter is better. So the porcelain's one example. There's something in clothing, in materials and fabrics, and maybe things like the iPlayer and some portable electronic devices also have kind of reversed the general rule that heavier is good. So you can reverse it, but it's hard.
So what specific one-sentence advice would you give as a take-home message to Liam so he wins the next barista competition?
Put it in a heavy glass.
There you go, Liam. Best of luck.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you. I think that's about all the time we have this morning. Professor Charles Spence has been our special guest, and it's been just so interesting. Literally, we could talk to you for days and days about the science of the senses and particularly what you're working with food. You are literally about to board a plane in the next few hours. What are you working on? What's the exciting thing that you're working on when you get home?
It's kind of synesthetic sounds for food. So working with the Fat Duck at the moment to look at how people actually match tastes and flavours to sound. So everyone actually turns out to match sweetness to high-pitched sounds and piano, and bitter tastes like the coffee we just mentioned to low pitch and brass. And when you find out these systematic mappings between tastes and flavours and music, you can start going to composers and sonic branding agencies and say, okay, can you make a specific soundtrack just for this dish and then play it back in the restaurant, either through the tannoy, through headphones like in the Sound of the Sea seafood dish, or even through new technology that allows you to make plates sing. So when you just pick up a plate or a glass, the sound of the sea or the synesthetic sound of sweetness will come out, and it'll come out just from the inside of the glass as you taste the drink.
I have a feeling those plates will not be able to live in a dishwasher anytime soon, will they? It's amazing stuff. We're so happy that we could pick your brain over the last hour, Professor Charles Spence. Thanks so much for joining us on Triple J this morning. And Dr. Carl, I will see you next week.
Yes, but so sad not to have Professor Charles with us again.
I know. Come back.